Hello and welcome to The World in 30 Minutes, the podcast on the events, policies and ideas that will shape the world from the European Council on Foreign Relations. My name is Mark Leonard. I'm director of ECFR. And this week's podcast will be about Israel. Earlier this month, Israel marked 75 years since its independence. There was much to celebrate. It has made peace with many of its Arab neighbours. It hosts a thriving tech sector. It's remained a pretty vibrant democracy, if you exclude the occupied territories, that is. But at the same time, the country is more polarized than it's ever been since its founding. And not everyone was in a party mood. Many people were, in fact, taking to the streets and revolting about all sorts of things going on within the country. In December last year, the Prime Minister, Bibi Netanyahu, introduced a series of very controversial judicial reforms, which brought hundreds of thousands of Israelis out onto the streets. And in the long term, the country's demography brings a lot of challenges, particularly to the idea of a two-state solution. On the one hand, there's a ever-growing ultra-Orthodox population. On the other, Arab Israelis are becoming a more and more important part of the population. And when it comes to the conflict with the Palestinians, that continues to fester, as demonstrated by recent clashes between Israel and Islamic Jihad, as well as rising tensions in the West Bank. Here to help us make sense of all these challenges and to think about what Israel means today, what its future is, and what kind of relationship it can have with Europe, we have a very special guest. Merav Mikhaili is the leader of Israel's Labour Party. She has been since 2021. She was Minister of Transport in the Bennett-Lapid government, which preceded Netanyahu's return as Prime Minister. And she has also been a very important part of Israel's political and cultural life as a television presenter for many years before she went into politics. Merav, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Hello, Mark. And it's nice to meet all your listeners.
So I'd like to talk about the big picture and everything that's going on with Israel at this kind of important moment. But a lot of people have been transfixed by the debate about judicial reforms over the last few weeks, which, as I said earlier, driven many people to the streets and raised all sorts of questions about Israel as a democracy, both internally, but also people are comparing it to countries like Hungary and others around the world. Can you maybe talk a bit about that before we kind of go into the bigger picture? How do you see these reforms? Where do they come from? How serious are they? What does it mean for the idea of Israel as a democracy?
Indeed, this is, the most major thing that's taking place in Israel at the moment and is kind of shadowing everything else. And really, I think, exhausts maybe the dilemma that Israel faces in its 75th year. And that is, where does it go from here? Because this coalition brought about this thing. We don't call it a judicial reform because it's not a judicial reform. It's an attempt to change the basic character of the state of Israel and turning it from a democratic liberal country with, you know, its challenges, as does every democracy has, or to make it a non-democratic religious state, which the whole package of the legislation that has to do with this coup that they call a reform actually will lead to. This is more than 140 proposed legislations, some big, some small, but all of them take Israel from being a country that has a democracy to a country that will be religious and non-democratic. So this is what's at stake here. And this is why hundreds of thousands of people have been taking to the streets for what is it like already 19 weeks, I think, from here to there, like they say. It's been a long time and many, many people keep coming out every week and keep working, you know, in any capacity which they may have. And we see, I think, every sector in Israeli society, starting from institutions which we never saw taking a stand, such as the central bank or former security highest positions or pilots, reserve pilots and fighters from other units in the army. We see doctors, we see social workers, we see teachers, we see really sectors who have never ever before taken a stand which is considered to be political, are now stepping up and saying, this is something that we will not have, we will not allow to happen. So these are sectors that we've never before ever seen taking a stand that's that may look like political, because the non-right part of Israeli society is very afraid of looking or seeming or being perceived or portrayed as political. And still, they stood up and said, this is a red line which we will not allow to cross. We will not have our democracy taken away from us.
Netanyahu put his reforms on hold, or coup, if you want to call it that, in April. And President Herzog has been sort of leading talks to try and find some sort of compromise since then. How do you see that developing? Has the Labour Party been involved in those talks?
No, the Labour Party was against getting into any talks or negotiation with the coalition about that, because we saw, as I mentioned, that every sector in Israeli society and really officials who never ever before spoke up against it very strongly. We saw world leaders speaking against it. So Netanyahu's only option to get some kind of legitimization from someone to this strongly non-legit coup was from the opposition. And that is why Labour was strongly against doing anything that would even suggest that we legitimize this thing. So we were very much against going into these talks. But since part of the opposition, my colleagues Gantz and Lapid, decided to join those talks, then we decided to also join as sort of the gatekeepers to make sure that they are not giving away anything that shouldn't be given away. Unfortunately, though, we weren't able to do what we came to do in these discussions, because they are held in a very non-transparent way. Labour was not invited to all the talks, and so we withdrew from them already a good number of weeks ago. First of all, because we will not be part of something that we are not really a part of. Secondly, as I said, because we couldn't perform the duty that we took on ourselves, and also to signal to the Israeli public that we can't vouch for what's happening there because it's not transparent. And so the principal problem with those talks remains. It is legitimizing something that should not be legitimized to begin with. This morning we saw something in Haaretz newspaper suggesting that they may agree on something in order to achieve something else. I still haven't gotten all the details, so I still haven't said anything publicly about that, but I doubt that that there is an agreement that I can also, agree to.
Okay. Maybe we can expand the focus a bit and talk about some of the trends in Israeli politics more generally. The party you lead has an august record. It's associated with Israel's founders and many of its greatest statesmen and women. You had a picture of Golda Meir on top of your head when we were talking earlier. But for the last 20 years or so, the left has been on a clear downwards trend, and the right has been dominating not just the institutions of government, but the discourse around politics more widely, in fact, almost completely in some areas. And in some ways, the reforms which we're talking about, they're brought in by the most right-wing government ever. And there may be a sort of culminating process of this bigger societal political shift, which has taken Israel into being a very different country to the one that I visited as a child and that my my forefathers emigrated to in the 1930s. Can you talk a bit about how you see that developing and why you think the Labour Party has gone from being this hegemonic force to one that's really struggling to have its voice heard, as you were describing earlier?
So first of all, let me commend you for describing very well and really capturing the situation in Israel. It's exactly 30 years that this thing has been developing. And there is a clear moment where it began, and that is 1993, when Benjamin Netanyahu was elected chair of the Likud for the first time and became the chair of the opposition to the late Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, who was in the midst of promoting the Oslo Accord, an unprecedented peace process with the Palestinians, which gave huge hope to Israelis and to Israel. Yitzhak Rabin realized at the time, A, that the big problem would be Iran, and that we have to get the Palestinian conflict off the table if we want to be able to deal well and effectively with the threat that it is becoming. And secondly, he realized that there's no avoiding finding a solution to this conflict that is consuming so much of Israel's energy and many, many other things. And the fact of the matter is that really, you know, the newspapers were in light blue, just to give you an idea of like how much hope there was in the air. But at the same time, obviously, there were big challenges of terror and such. And when Netanyahu became the chair of the opposition, he took the campaign against Oslo and against peace and against Yitzhak Rabin and against labor and against democracy. He took it many, many levels up, unfortunately, to measures which we didn't have in Israel before, a lot of incitement and violence and demonization and delegitimization that we didn't have in our public and political sphere before that. And changing the essential question of where does Israel go to the one that we are seeing so clearly and strongly now. Is it a liberal democratic state that is the home of the Jewish people, but has equality for all and has security that stems not only from its military power, but also from peace with our neighbors? Or is it a religious, non-democratic country that is constantly invested in conflicts, military and otherwise? Unfortunately, the violence and the incitement have prevailed first and foremost because they led to the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. And unfortunately, again, they continue to prevail because we see this in many, many other places in the world that are dealing with far right and the far right with those standards. I think what happened now is that a lot of things that were covered maybe under whitewashes, words such as security or Jewish or I don't know, have now came out for what they really are. The question of democracy versus authoritative state, the question of democracy versus a religious state. And that is what's on the line now. Now, in the process of this violence and incitement that, as I said, led to the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, it also led to diminishing the political power of the liberal camp in Israel in general. It's not, I mean, labor's weakening, and it's dramatic because it was, before I took it on, it was almost this, it was always gone. I mean, now, yes, we are very tiny. We are only 4 mandates, but when I took it in 2021, it was on its way out completely. It had 3 mandates and 0 in the polls for a long time. So, it's not only labor. It's the fact that the bodies that wanted to replace labor, first of all, did not, are not, to this day, are not advocating for the same ideology, the liberal Zionist ideology that really formed and established the state of Israel. And secondly, do not have enough political power to be able to form a democratic liberal government. And that is the biggest challenge that lies ahead of us, which we must be able to really live up to.
And that challenge is kind of mainly a demographic challenge. It's interesting. People always say demography is destiny. And a lot of people thought that it was the demography which was going to drive the peace process and which was going to lead to a lot of the developments that you talked about. But interestingly, the social basis for that sort of secular, peaceful, democratic Israel that you're describing seems to have been challenged by massive inflows of people to the country. Demography's led it in a very different direction to what people hoped in the beginning of the 80s.
Well, I always remember that demographic prophets usually do not fulfill, you know, that usually, I mean, if it were true, then first of all, our planet would not have been able to contain us long ago. And in America, Republicans would have been like already, you know, without any chance for a president, et cetera, et cetera. So I remember very, very clearly that nothing is given. Nothing is a given. Nothing is fate. I do not believe in fate. I believe that we create our destiny. And it's in our hands, and we have to realize it, and we have to act on it. We have to be able to take responsibility and to do what is needed in order for the reality we want to see form by us. So I am not discouraged by demographics at all. What I am is worried about the unequal resources that the right and the extreme right and the settlers and the ultra-Orthodox have, which enable them to take over, as you described, to take over the political and the public sphere in Israel and to take over the discourse. Resources that unfortunately we do not have on our side of the political map, and we have to obtain in order to be able to fight back effectively, more effectively than we do today. So my concentration is on the things that we can actually do and not on the things that are less in our hands and, you know, not give in to whatever profits.
So you talked a lot about peace earlier, and the kind of old way that we thought about peace was that there was a sort of positive relationship between peace within Israel, working with the Palestinians towards a two-state solution, and peace with the Arab neighbors outside, that in a way the Palestinians were the gatekeepers to a kind of wider peace process. But those two trends have been decoupled recently, in that there have been some advances with Arab neighbors, particularly around a sort of shared fear of Iran, and the Abraham Accords were the most powerful example of that. And people are now talking about the possibility of having some sort of settlement with Saudi Arabia, which would build on the Abraham Accords. But on the other hand, the two-state solution has never looked further from a reality, both on the ground as settlements continue in different places, but also there is no peace process that worth its name anymore, and not even any kind of leaders in many parts of the territories that Israel could talk to, even if it wanted to.
If you could talk about how you see the future of peace, both internally with the Palestinians, but also how that relates to the kind of wider prospect of de-escalation with Arab countries.
It took me a minute to realize that when you're saying internally, you mean the Palestinians. In Israel, it certainly is not perceived as internally. And it's part of the challenge to not have all of the population, the Palestinian population, a part of the one state, because this will be the end of the Zionist vision. And the Zionist vision was a very liberal one that completely and utterly drives for equality without any reservations. But in order for the Jewish people to have a place where we can define ourselves, we need to have equality between a Jewish majority and anyone else, and to have a border between us and between the Palestinians who are in need for their own self-determination. So it's obviously the two-state solution is not around the corner. But first of all, I'm speaking as an Israeli leader, a solution, a political, peaceful solution for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a number one interest. As I said, because this conflict is consuming so much from Israel in many, many ways, and is, by the way, linked directly to the so-called judicial reform, the coup that we are seeing now, because it derives a lot from settlers' desire to do in the West Bank whatever they want to be to do without being accountable to anyone. And the Supreme Court in Israel and judicial system is one of the last barriers that they are facing constantly. Now, what we're seeing again is, yes, there was the Abraham Accords, which, of course, I voted for. And, you know, any agreement that we can achieve with any one of our neighbors is something that we should very much try to achieve. But it's very clear that Saudi Arabia is something that cannot work without some kind of progress in the Palestinian channel. I think it keeps coming back to anyone who thinks differently. There's every time there's this legend where we can promote the peace with other Arab countries without doing anything constructive about the Palestinian issue, and that does not prove itself to be true, certainly not regarding Saudi Arabia and the new agreement that they have. They have an agreement with Iran. So I think we need to look at this reality. Anyone who thinks that we can continue to avoid the Palestinian issue. There's also, separating the talks with other Arab countries, separating them from the Palestinians is, in my mind, a completely counter interest of what Israel should do. It should be the other way around. Leverage the influence that others may have in order to allow us and the Palestinians to be able to reach some kind of agreement, and B, of course, one that would be good for all. This is what I would aspire for, because I'm trying to think of the biggest possible good that will make everyone's life much, much, much better.
But what you're saying, saying is, music to the ears of all Europeans who supported this approach that you're describing with money, with diplomacy, with political capital, with lots of dreams over the last few decades. But the gulf between their stated positions and what's happening on the ground is kind of getting more and more painful as time goes on. What do you think it's kind of realistic to... So if we agree totally with where you want to get to, obviously we wouldn't start from where we're at the moment, but what do you think it's realistic to imagine happening in the kind of near term over the next few months and years?
No, it completely depends on what happens within Israel, because as long as we continue to have the domination of the right wing and the settlers' right, far-right power and the religious authorities that really have such a grasp on Israeli politics, then I suspect that we will see more of the same, and it'll get worse constantly. So this is why it's so important that we wage our political fight within Israel, so the liberal camp can go back to power and start doing what needs to be done regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the relationship with the rest of the Arab countries. You said this is music to Europeans' ears. That's I always say The archive is my friend and my alibi, because I, long before I came to politics, you know, I was, one of my many activities was promoting the Arab League Peace Initiative at the time, which is in principle still there. Of course, a lot of things have happened, but the idea that is in the basis of this initiative is one that we should seek to promote. That is what I believe strongly today. And this is one of the main reasons why I am still fighting within Israeli politics.
Thank you very much. We're coming towards the end of our time, but given that we started with the 75th anniversary of Israel, maybe we can look forward 75 years and tell us, what kind of country do you think Israel will be in 75 years' time, and what the next 75 years of Israeli history are going to contain?
Remember, we talked about that there's no fate. It's a choice that we make. Humans determine their own fate. So Israel can continue going in the path of becoming less democratic, more religious, more less good for itself, for its inhabitants, and for its neighbors. And it can choose the path of going for its strengths and in innovation, in creativity, in so many successes, and in being also such in everything that has to do with democracy, with giving more freedom and more equality of opportunities to all of its citizens, men, women, the gay community, Jews, non-Jews, et cetera, et cetera. It's all there. The potential here is huge. We just have to decide to go for it. I know that I am committed to take Israel in that direction.
And you mentioned a lot before about how, you know, any progress is going to be endogenous. These are Israeli political battles which need to be fought, and that's what you're committing yourself to do. And Europeans, obviously, not even the most important external players to the extent that they can shape things. But what do you think European governments should be doing at the moment to kind of encourage the sort of developments that you've been describing?
You know, I think it was Mark Twain who said that patriotism means standing by your country at all times and by your government only when it deserves it. So it's always very complicated and kind of tricky as an Israeli leader. You don't want to invite anyone to do anything that may be portrayed as, you know, as pressure from outside of or anything of the sort. But I think it's very clear that this government is threatening now also the support that European governments are giving to the liberal and democratic forces within Israel. It's one of the many legislations that they are threatening with. The most important thing for me to tell Europeans and democratic forces everywhere is, do not give up on us. Israel and Israeli citizens are not, by large, of course, we have very strong far-right non-democratic forces, but the majority of the people here do believe in democracy, do believe in equality, do believe even in peace after all these years of strong brainwash against it. Do not give up on us and stand with us. We can prevail.
Okay, wonderful. What an inspiring note to end on. There's one thing left to do on this podcast, and that's our bookshelf segment. What do you want?
Wow.
What's on your bookshelf at the moment?
Well, I often wondered, is it even responsible of me to read my favorite prose rather than things that have to do with work? But what I'm reading at the moment, and this is like this is what I love. I think maybe my most favorite activity. I'm reading Edith Wharton's The Age of Innocence. This kind of literature is my favorite. Feminist women from classic Europe and the beginning of America, which, you know, corresponds with the classical Europe. This is really my weakness. And when it's such good literature, and it's such, and these are such important human lessons and feminist lessons, then yes, by all means.
Fantastic. So we'll put up a link to all the publications we mentioned, including Edith Wharton's Age of Innocence on our website at ecfr.eu. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, please do head to whatever platform you use to download it and subscribe to future episodes. And while you're there, it would be wonderful if you could give us a positive review and maybe even a 5-star rating, because it will help other people come to the podcast.
Yes, by all means, I'm giving you a 5-star rating.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for listening. But for now, from Mirav and myself, Mark Leonard, it's goodbye. The researcher for this podcast is Chiara Bricker, and the editor of this episode is Mireia Farrow-Sarratz.